This summer, I'm taking a new approach to styling the smallest spaces in my house with help from Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has the small space solutions that America's waited 250 years for, like retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, dinner party ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish spacious Bobopedic sofas, and feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back in even the smallest rooms. Plus, I know that Bob's styles are backed by thousands of real five-star customer reviews, so I can trust that the furniture that I'm getting is not just affordable, but built to last. And the best part? Bob's furniture ships fast, so I can enjoy my new styles all summer long. So when you're ready to ditch the furniture you're not excited about for the latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.
Welcome. This is Barrel It Up, and I'm Jay Jambrone. We received a new book in the mail. It has been written by a previous guest of ours on the podcast, Stu Sallow. After reading the book, I was sure we needed to talk to Stu so you can all learn about it and you can go out and get it. And it's The Things We Do for Glove. There's what it looks like right there. And we'll be talking a lot about that for the rest of the time we're together. And we will make sure that we also have the contact information in the description, so you'll have an easy way to go about finding the book. Stu, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure, as always.
And but there was something I left out in the last time we talked. And if somebody wants to find out how Stu got to this point of writing this book in his life, you could go back to the two shows that we did with him. It's in our library. You just go to the library and scan through there, and you'll find those shows. But there was one thing I forgot to talk about, and it really came home back to me reading the book because there's a similar character in the book to Stu's wife. And so it got me thinking as I was reading the book, who is this woman that puts up with this guy playing 100 games a year all over the country?
Well, permit me to introduce my wife, Mari Navar, as an answer to your question. But, you know, I should hasten to point out, Jay, that the characters in this book are fictional characters.
Of course.
And so the character in the book that you're referring to is Mila.
Uh-huh.
And she is the wife of Sal Rabin, who is the protagonist of the story, the main character. And like all authors, there are characters in the story that resemble characters out of your life. There are stories that come through in a novel that are based on stories that we all, you know, experience in our lives.
Right.
But I don't want to give the impression that Mila is my wife.
Mm-hmm.
That said, there are some similarities. And, you know, I certainly do give my wife a lot of credit for putting up with my baseball addiction. At the same time, she also supports it for her own selfish reasons.
Ah.
Because she kind of likes getting me out of the house for a week or two at a time and having the place to herself and not have to deal with all the stuff that you have to deal with when you're living with somebody.
Yeah.
And you know, there's that part of it as well. But, you know, who is she? She's someone who I married 27 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
She was well aware of that I am an athlete, and
right,
that my athletic endeavors are important to me. She didn't share those athletic endeavors exactly, but she has grown enamored of, let's just say, the drama of sports. And one of the teams that I've been a fan of for many years is the Los Angeles Lakers.
Uh-huh.
And she and I have become sort of addicted to watching Lakers games. And so she's we kind of share an affinity for athletic competition.
Mm-hmm.
That said, she herself is not an athlete, and she almost never comes to any of my baseball games. She did come out to South Florida with me a couple months ago when I played in the Roy Hobbs Sunshine Classic tournament.
Oh, wow.
But I think that was mostly because it was an opportunity for her to escape from Colorado during the middle of winter and be in a warmer climate and just take a break from our regular lives together. So that was pretty fun, though.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing that, you know, anybody of our ilk that it's reading the book especially understands that when we first started playing, the wives and kids came out regularly, and little by little, they just kind of disappeared. And so instead of having 10 or 20 people at a game, all of a sudden, you're out there and it's very quiet in the stands.
You know, what's interesting about that, Jay, is that playing the game we love has become increasingly important to us.
Right.
As our time draws closer, that we won't be able to do it anymore. And the opposite is true for our spouses.
Yeah.
It becomes increasingly meaningless to them.
Yeah.
At the same time that it becomes increasingly more meaningful to us. I think
right.
That's kind of an interesting little paradox.
Yeah, like you say, you know, they've got their quiet time that they can do whatever they need
right.
to get done without you underfoot and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
Now, this wasn't the first book, right?
Well, that's true. This is my second book. The thing that these two books have in common is that they're based on learning life lessons and developing a set of principles to live by through your passions. So in the case of the first book, The Deadhead Cyclist, my passion is music and cycling.
Right.
And specifically, The Grateful Dead has always been sort of the soundtrack to my life since I was about 19 years old. And I wrote the book, The Deadhead Cyclist, out of my desire to put forth a set of life principles that I learned through the passions of music and The Grateful Dead and cycling. And specifically through the lyrics of The Grateful Dead, for those of your audience who aren't familiar, The Grateful Dead continues to be a concept that carries forth certain principles that were developed during the 60s that are just as relevant now as they ever were.
Right.
Principles of love and harmony and togetherness, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I have to interrupt for a second because I lost. Someone's calling me, and I lost my video.
Wow, I can still see you and hear you.
There you go. I'm back. Okay.
Yeah.
And in this case, in the case of this book, you know, I have a great passion for baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And out of my passion for baseball, other life principles have come forward in my life.
Yeah.
And principles that sort of contradicted the principle of winning is everything.
Uh-huh.
The famous Vince Lombardi quote, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. And what I've had to learn along the way in my baseball travels is that winning isn't everything.
Right.
It's not the most important thing. It's not the only thing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And that good sportsmanship and friendships and the general love of the game and the love of our teammates and the love of ourselves as athletes and having the ability to play the game that we love is far more important than the things we do for glove.
Yeah.
And that's where the title of the book came from.
Yeah.
The other thing that I wanted to say about the similarities between these two books is what one thing that you said earlier is that, you know, we get to a certain age and we are feeling the need to not immortalize ourselves, because I'm not under any illusions that 100 years from now, anybody's going to know anything of me. Certainly not because I wrote these books. But at the same time, at least for my family and friends, I have the ability to, you know, have some sort of influence with respect to values and what's important and the things I've learned along the way through my passions. And you feel the need to kind of put those things down in writing.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing about that, I think, is that once you declare something, once you've declared that these principles are important to you, well, you sure as hell better live up to them on the ball field. Otherwise, you're a hypocrite.
Yeah.
And so it's been really helpful to me to declare the principles that I believe in so that I can, in turn, live up to them myself.
Right.
As much as inspire other people to live up to them.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. Somebody was talking, this won't be an exact quote, but somebody in baseball was mentioning recently about that baseball teaches you how to recover from failure because you're going to fail a very high percentage of the time in that game. Yeah.
Yes, that's definitely it. That's one of the overarching principles of baseball, and it differs from other sports significantly.
Yeah. why now for that book, for this book, new book?
Well,
was there a seed that says, hey, I can write this right now?
I think after I wrote The Deadhead Cyclist and spent the ensuing months and years promoting it and trying to get it into people's hands through various means, I felt like I wanted to write another book.
Uh-huh.
I'd learned a lot from the first book that I wrote, and I wanted to apply some of the knowledge that I had gained from that experience
in
writing a second book. And there was a moment where I had this kind of inspiration about the primary subject of the book, which is learning that winning isn't everything.
Right.
A lesson that I had to learn the hard way myself. And I think that I just wanted to convey that to everybody. And like I said, declare it as something that was important to me that I was committing to in my life in a whole new way. And I had this inspiration about a creative way of doing that through the story of this character, Sal Rabin, and the metamorphosis that he went through from being a type A win at all costs senior baseball pitcher to a gentler, kinder version of himself that made him more appealing as a teammate, let's just say. Because the original, and of course I exaggerate this in the book.
Sure.
Although having said that, I have to admit that that I've exhibited some of the unsavory behavior that this character in the book has exhibited, perhaps not to the same degree that he did.
Yeah.
It's always exaggerated and fictionalized when you put it down in the form of a novel.
Sure.
But at the same time, I've been so blessed and so touched with the ability to learn these hard lessons through my love of baseball.
Uh-huh.
You know, in the case of The Deadhead Cyclist, I wanted to give something back to the Grateful Dead community that had given me so much.
Uh-huh.
And I think the same thing was true here in the context of this baseball book. I wanted to give something back to the baseball community, and particularly the senior baseball community. And I should specify for listeners out there that senior doesn't necessarily mean, you know, 65, 70 years of age.
Right.
I don't know when the MSBL, I don't know when the MABL becomes the MSBL. Maybe you know at what age that.
I don't know that there is a distinction anymore. I think that distinction's kind of gone away.
Yeah. But I think men's senior baseball league and the word senior means that you're not a kid anymore.
Right.
You know, and I think that can apply to 30, 35, 40-year-olds as well as 65 and 70-year-olds. But in any event, I wanted to give something back to the senior baseball community because it's meant so much to me to be part of it.
Right.
And I've gained so much from being part of it, not the least of which is hundreds and hundreds of baseball friends from all over the country, from literally Maine to Florida to California to Washington. It's just so wonderful. And in doing the marketing for this book, I went through countless emails that I'd saved meticulously over the years from various managers.
Yeah.
Who would send out a list to people. For example, there was this one guy, there's this one manager, Jay, who I remember. You know, he would send out a list to over 100 people and say, I'm going to enter a team in this tournament. Get back to me if you're interested. And I saved all those emails and I have all those hundreds and hundreds of emails. And so I was able to compile a list of baseball contacts that came just under 1,000.
Wow.
It was at 984 when I finally went through every folder and every email and meticulously transferred all of the email addresses. So some of you out there have been getting my propaganda for this book. I'm not going to apologize for that, but that's the reason. And if you don't want to receive it anymore, you can simply unsubscribe. And it happens automatically. And a handful of people have unsubscribed.
Yeah, that happens.
And I know who you are.
And I know. I wish I had never kept that, anyway. those lists of people very in a proper place. So I have paper after paper, small papers, large papers like this, all over the place with all these email addresses on there, especially now that I'm doing this. And I go, oh, I forgot about that guy. I think he'd be a really good person to talk to. And
well, perhaps we can work out something, Jay, because I've got this list of 984 ball players who at one time or another were in some way affiliated with one or more of the teams that I've played on over the years. And, you know, maybe we could work out something to send out something to all those people about Barrel It Up.
Well, I found out there's a guy that I just interviewed whose interview will come up, who'll drop in a few weeks. And he was on my original 1988 team. And we won our league, so therefore we went to the World Series.
Yeah,
and I haven't talked to him because he moved on to other teams eventually and all that. And I haven't talked to him in probably 30 years. And I found him because we both have the same dentist.
Oh, is that right?
A dentist who loves to talk, especially talk about baseball.
Well, it's good if the dentist talks, as long as they don't expect you to talk while it's going
on. That's right. Well, he does sometimes. Yeah, it's a little difficult. But and so he put the two together. And then found out that we had both played together. And so I talked to him and had a great interview with him, learned a lot of stuff about him. And I might have to start a 65 team for the World Series now because him and his buddy that used to pitch for me want to get back into playing again.
Okay.
And he was the number, I can't remember what year he got drafted in, but he was the number two overall pick in the draft.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, but got a sore arm in the minor leagues. And, of course, back in the day, like you're talking, you know, about situations that happened to you with your arm, back in the day in the 80s, 70s, and 80s, they didn't care for pitchers the way they care for them now in the minor leagues. Mm-hmm. And so guys like him that were very, very good went by the wayside because nobody was there to take care of what needed to be taken care of for them. So.
Well, and they also didn't have some of the procedures that are available today.
Yeah.
You know, Tommy John surgery comes to mind. You know, well, that was named after.
He could have been a candidate for that because that was his problem. That area of the elbow was his problem.
Yeah.
But, you know, they didn't have the kind of trainers they do have today. They didn't have, they had a roving pitching coach, not a pitching coach on the team, things like that. So a lot of guys went by the wayside as a result of that. But but before I ask the next question, there is a, I told you ahead of time, there is a quote in the very beginning of the book, and I'd love you to, I think it's really an awesome quote. And for us, not only in baseball, but any part of life, that if you could go over that with us, it'd be great.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I guess I would introduce this by saying that the storyline of the book, as we've sort of alluded to along the way already during our conversation, is a metamorphosis of this individual from a win at all costs pitcher who would behave in any way he thought he needed to in order to win games, to someone who understood that there were more important things than winning and losing games. I think it's just important to restate that context, that that's the gist of the storyline of the book. How he gets there is what's creative and interesting, and that's the sci-fi part of the story.
Yeah,
that has to do with extracting DNA and injecting it into teammates and things of that nature. You know, and again, you know, like we talked about earlier, I don't want to give away too much of the storyline because all of you guys out there and girls out there need to read the book.
That's right.
To find out those kinds of details.
Yeah.
But at a certain point towards the end of the book, when the storyline begins to resolve, as it does in most novels, the following quote is an example of how that's conveyed. And it goes like this. Success in baseball, in business, family, or any other walk of life, is not about trying to create uniformity by getting others to think and act like you do. It's about honoring the individuality and uniqueness of every member of the team or organization. It's about building a culture where everyone understands and embraces their role. It's about respecting each player and treating them the way you would like to be treated, even when they make the inevitable mistakes that result in you having to throw a few extra pitches or even in losing a game.
Mm.
And that kind of sums up the principle that overarching principle that is conveyed throughout the entire story.
Right, right. Now, when did it hit you to use sci-fi as your method of handling this?
Well, that's a good question. And I think it was born out of the idea that if I could only play every position on the field myself, then I wouldn't be subject to having to throw those few extra pitches and losing games that should have been won.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, that's extremely egocentric and narcissistic to think that any of us as imperfect ball players, and especially as our imperfections begin to grow alongside of our age, would be able to play perfect baseball, and that you could create the perfect team by playing every position yourself.
Right.
But I have thought to myself numerous times while I'm on the mound pitching a game, and you work a guy inside and you get a strike and then he fouls one off and you have him 0-2, and then you pitch him away a couple times and now it's 2-2, and then he fouls off a couple more and pretty soon it's 3-2, and the next thing you know, you finally throw that perfect pitch and you get him to hit this weak pop-up behind third base. And the third baseman drops the ball in shallow left field after you've just finished a nine-pitch at bat where you perfectly worked this guy and got him to hit a weak pop-up that should have been caught. When things like that inevitably happen, it can be extremely frustrating for a pitcher. especially a pitcher of a certain age whose arm is a little bit sore and had to take ibuprofen just to get through the game. You know, now I've got to start all over again with the next batter. It can be pretty frustrating.
Right.
And I have thought to myself at times, what if I could play every position on the field? Wouldn't that be great?
You know,
it's like this little fantasy.
Yeah.
And in the storyline of the things we do for Glove, this pitcher, Sal Raben, has that kind of an experience, and the game winds up being lost that should have been won. And he goes home and he has a dream. And in this dream, he's playing every position on the field. And he wakes up from this dream, and he feels compelled by this dream in a certain way.
Yeah.
I think we've all had experiences of having dreams that we wake up from and feel compelled by in a unique way.
Mm-hmm.
What was that all about? You know, when you try and interpret, well, the meaning of this particular dream is not that hard to interpret. You don't need a genius in psychotherapy to help you figure out what a dream like that means.
Right.
But he continues to be obsessed with this idea. And that's kind of where the story takes off from there. And I have, so to answer your question, you know, I have had those kinds of experiences.
Uh-huh.
And I've had to learn the hard way that you have to just accept that your teammates are not perfect,
yeah.
that you yourself are not perfect, that none of us are perfect, and that there's the reason that we're out there playing ball is not just to win. I mean, we all want to win.
Yeah.
And I don't want to give the impression that I don't care about winning anymore. When I say that winning isn't everything, I don't mean it's nothing.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
It's still motivates you to excel and give your best effort at all times, that 110% that we all talk about.
Yeah.
And so I'm not saying that winning is nothing, but I am saying that there are more important things than winning. I've had to learn that the hard way. And I wanted to convey that in this story. And I think that's the best way that I can answer your question.
I think that, you know, so many of us have had that. I had a series in Arizona where I played second base the whole series, made no errors during that. And that's, mm-hmm. I didn't care about hitting. I didn't care about anything else. I wanted to go through a complete series without making an error.
Yes,
and, I've been there. One time I accomplished that. And mm-hmm. then you see somebody else out in the field who makes multiple errors during that game or that series.
Yep.
And you say to yourself, I can't be everywhere. And that's exactly what you're
yep.
talking about.
There you go. But what I've had to learn the hard way, and what the character in the book portrays, is that what you really need to learn is to say to that person, hey, you'll get the next one.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
Right.
It's all good. You know, that's really because when we make an error, we already feel bad about it.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no one who feels worse about it than we do.
Yeah.
I remember in a recent tournament, I was playing second base and I let one go through my legs. And it's so embarrassing when that happens. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
But there's no one who felt worse about it than I did. And there's no amount of criticism
yeah.
that is going to make me feel worse about it. And in fact, what you want to do is you want to make someone feel better about it.
Right.
That's what being a good teammate is. Even if it costs you a game, which
yeah.
you know, there's a few stories in the book where where these kinds of miscues, you know, wind up causing the team to lose games,
yeah.
literally. And there's one case where Sal himself has gotten the team in a position to win a game. A pop-up was hit in the infield. And all he has to do is catch this pop-up and the game is over.
Mm-hmm.
Second baseman comes up behind him just as he's about to catch the ball for the final out of the game, bumps into him from behind. The ball lands on the bridge of his nose.
Oh, ouch.
Breaks his glasses and cuts into his skin in a way where he has to go to the emergency room after the game and get some amount of stitches. I think it might have been 7.
Yeah.
And while this is happening, on a 3-2 count with 2 outs, the runners are going, and 2 runs scored, and the game was lost because this second baseman bumped into him from behind. This didn't happen in real life.
Yeah.
Something similar happened in real life, but it's fictionalized, of course.
Yeah.
And, you know, what does Sal do? He blasts this guy.
Yeah.
You moron. Didn't you see I was about to catch the ball? And, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, exactly the wrong thing to say to somebody at a moment like that.
Yeah.
So these things happen. And at the end of the day, you're still driving home. You're having a beer after the game or a burger with the guys. And the next morning, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Yeah. In the whole scheme of things. Yeah.
But what does matter is that you made this guy feel worse than he already felt about making a mistake.
Yeah.
And that does matter. And so that's why the things we do for love are far more important than the things we do for glove.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got 2 comments on that. Number one, Stu, if you're pitching and I'm playing second base, if you call it, it's yours.
Thank you.
If somebody calls it, okay, you better be sure you just called it. But
okay.
You called it. So.
However, there's another aspect to this book that I want to bring the audience's attention to. And that is that within this book lie some of the mysterious principles of baseball.
Right.
That I'm teaching as someone who studied the game for many years.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those principles is that the pitcher does not catch pop-ups in the infield.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, and this is true at the professional level far more than it's true in the amateur level.
Yeah.
But because we've studied the game of baseball all these years, you know, we understand that this is sort of one of the unwritten rules of baseball, that the pitcher does not catch pop-ups in the infield. And so that principle is conveyed in the context of this story.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is that I teach a lesson about how difficult it is to steal bases off a left-handed pitcher.
Right.
And in doing so, I teach where the term southpaw came from,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not going to say now because you have to read the book.
That's right, I have to read the book.
But not that you can't find it out somewhere else. But it has to do with the position of the field. But how you steal off a lefty pitcher is something that I have studied extensively as a base stealer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very dangerous to try and steal off a left-handed pitcher. You can easily get picked off, and I've fallen prey to that many times. But there are a lot of some of the finer points of baseball that are taught in this book.
Yeah.
That, you know, that I also have learned over the years and researched during the course of writing the book, that, you know, that I think people will find interesting.
Yeah, and the second part of that was part of the book, and people have to read it to find out. Part of the book reminded me that when I was in Little League, because you talk about Little League in the book extensively too. When I was in Little League, I was by the time I was 12, I was the shortstop. My third baseman was a kid from my street that had a withered left arm.
Withered?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
It was polio or what had caused it.
A weak left arm?
Yeah.
I see. It was sort of like a little bit deformed.
Yeah, it wasn't usable for him.
Uh-huh, I see.
But he was playing third base. And it was tough. You know, you're learning a lesson because he was trying with all his might to be a third baseman. And if he made an error or if he struck out at the plate, he would cry every time.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're 11, 12 years old, how do you handle that?
Right.
You know, Unfortunately, he's passed away now and everything, so I don't get a chance to talk to him anymore. But it was, you know, that's something that reminded me from reading the book about a situation, you know, situations like that.
Yes, there's a story in the book where Sal is dealing with a very deep moral crisis, a moral dilemma about whether to fess up with his teammates about something he did against their knowledge. Let's just say that way.
Yeah.
And while he's in the depths of despair trying to make this decision, he drives by a Little League field and he sees a Little League game going on. And so he pulls over and stops and goes and sits in the stands with all the parents that are watching the game. And he sees this game end and this kid cries at the end of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, which was it? I guess it was the batter. It was the batter that failed with runners on base and the game on the line. And I juxtapose the despair of the failing batter with the elation of the winning pitcher in that particular scenario in a way that conveys how seriously we take the game of baseball.
Right.
And Sal wanted to go over to this kid and put his arm around him and tell him, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
It's not something to cry about. This isn't going to matter a few days from now, and it certainly isn't going to matter when you get to be my age and are playing senior baseball. You know? But he realized that we all have to learn these lessons for ourselves, and there's no way that he could have consoled a kid in that kind of a situation.
Right. Right.
And so he refrained from doing so.
Yeah.
But I think that's the story that you're,
that's one,
you're referring
one.
To when, yeah. When, yeah. When you bring up your third baseman.
The one other thing that struck me too, because it's something that I talk about each time we're going to start a new, whether I'm managing or not managing, and we're going to start a new game or a new series, and that is no talk of religion or politics in the dugout.
Well, good luck with that. And the reason I say that is because I have engaged in numerous conversations with my fellow ball players about these subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there is sort of a unwritten rule that we don't talk about religion or politics in the dugout, one of the things that makes playing senior baseball meaningful to me, and I think to many others, is getting to know people.
Oh, yeah.
And really understanding that we're all different in our beliefs and in our political points of view. There are many differences, and yet we're all fundamentally the same.
Mm-hmm.
We're all playing baseball because we enjoy it. We all want to stay fit and healthy into our senior years. And I think it's really beautiful to find people who you disagree with politically. I'm thinking of one guy in particular right now who you disagree with politically or religiously, and yet you still find common ground for that relationship and for that friendship. I think we need more of that in the world. So it's not so, I would amend that rule a little bit, and I'm not saying you need to, but if I was managing a team, I would amend that rule to something like this. If you do find yourself getting real with some of your teammates about subjects like religion and politics, we have a culture on this team that we do so respectfully and non-judgmentally.
Right, right.
And, you know, I guess maybe that's unrealistic. Maybe it's easier to just, you know, cut it out entirely. But I would have lost a lot if I hadn't been able to talk to some of my teammates about some of these things. And so, You know, I would augment it in that way, if it were my team. And by the way, just for the record, I have no interest in managing baseball teams. I've been in charge of my own business, and I've been the boss for over 40 years. I don't need to be the boss anymore.
That's right.
What I prefer is to be the right-hand man, the guy that the manager comes to and says, what do you think?
Yeah,
can you take
right.
this guy out? Do you think we should we bunt here? You know, how should we steal here? You know, I want to be like a consultant.
That's right. That's right.
I don't want to be the manager. I just want to be a consultant. And that role has worked pretty well for me. So I'm going to stick to that. And I'm going to let you manage the teams.
Well, that's basically what I did for the last 73 team that I went to the World Series in, is that I said, you know, you got all these guys here that have paid big money to be on this team and everything.
Yeah.
And if you have to have me go out and take over for somebody, they get hurt, whatever, that's fine. I would be happy to scorekeep for you and to be a rah-rah guy for the team. And you can ask me any question, because I've done this for 30 some years as a manager. But it's your team. It's your team.
Right.
You've got to make the final decisions on everything. So,
You know, one more thing about the religion and politics thing. Sometimes you get involved in a conversation of that nature and you find it going south, as in becoming contentious and not respectful, but argumentative. I think it's important at that moment to agree to disagree and move on.
Yeah.
Sometimes these conversations do not bear fruit. I think they often can, and I'd like to believe they can, and I've seen them bear fruit many times.
Yeah.
In the way that I just described. But sometimes they don't. Sometimes they become contentious and negative. And I think at that point, it's important to be wise and back off and change the subject.
That reminds me of, first of all, those conversations and the conversations in general in the dugout is why this show exists. Because I realized that there was interesting people and did interesting things.
Right.
Even their teammates don't know about them. But you learn these things, and I think the public in general should hear some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is, when I was on the board of directors for our league in Southern California, we had one guy, and we get along really good now. We've had our difficulties when we were on opposite teams in various tournaments, where it got a little nasty once in a while. But we've gone past that and become friends since then, because I never let any of that stuff fester. You know, what happened then is then, and we can be whatever we are now. But he was on the board of directors, and he left the board of directors because he usually lost all the votes on the board of directors when anything came up for a vote. And my point to him was, but you're valuable. Whether we might, even if we disagree with you, we're not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we've come up with an idea or a rule doesn't mean that rule is perfect. You may lose the overall vote, but you may have input there that changes that rule in such a way as it makes it a better rule.
Mm-hmm.
And I always had trouble conveying that to him. You don't always have to win those arguments to have an input and to be important. So
how did that wind up for you?
Well, you know, we get along fine now. We, you know, at all the tournaments we talk, he was even on one of my father's son, him and his kid on my father's son team. Mm-hmm. And we get along great now. Now, we had some issues when we played each other a few times. We beat him in a semifinal game because he didn't put his best pitcher out there, because he scoured us beforehand and didn't think we were going to be tough enough. And I had the right pitcher and he had the wrong pitcher in the semifinal game. And so the next year we played him again, and he beat the living crap out of us and poured it on and poured it on and poured it on. And, but then after that, we found common ground on a lot of stuff, and been helpful to each other in past, in future years. And, if he's available on a team, and if he's available and a manager's looking for a guy, I'll say, hey, call up this guy, and, have him come out.
It's really important to be able to resolve those kinds of differences and not hold grudges.
Yeah.
I've had those kinds of experiences many times, or not many times, but several times.
Yeah.
One comes to mind in particular. And, I think it's real easy to just leave those things the way they are and let that negative energy exist. It takes a lot of courage and character to step forward to somebody and say, look, I don't want to have this ongoing issue between us. Let's get this worked out so that we can enjoy sharing a ball field in the future. Usually that works out really well. Even with umpires, I've had that experience.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Of reaching out to an umpire who I was rude to as a pitcher. Sometimes that happens. Although now we have the head tapping thing.
Yeah.
And I'm an advocate of the movement that I think you're going to see a movement in this direction now that they're doing this in the major leagues. Of obviously we don't have the technology available to overturn balls and strikes calls. But what we do have is it being modeled that if you disagree with a call, you don't have to yell at the umpire and say that ball was clearly outside and you're blind and all that kind of stuff. Instead, I'm trying to start a movement where we just tap our head and the umpire goes, okay, I understand you disagree with that call. And here we go. I think that's a much better way of expressing dissent.
Yeah. Well, one other example that just happened this year about, and I think it's important, and I think it's important in the book and everything, what you're talking about in general about getting past these things with teammates and umpires and all these things, how you can get past them. This last year, I had somebody that I ended up on the same team with that absolutely hates me with a passion as a manager. Thinks I'm the worst manager that ever existed, and on and on and on and on and on. Doesn't even want to say hello to me in any circumstance. Well, we were on the same team this year, and I don't want to say I'm the better guy, but we're doing practice the day before the tournament starts, and he's over there at third base fielding ground balls, normally plays center field, and I'm playing over at first. And he's the only guy on the infield during batting practice that could get the ball to me. So I go up to the manager and I say, that's got to be your third baseman because he's the only guy who's getting the ball over there. Mm-hmm. And we need that because defense is extremely important. And so by the end of the week, we're fine with each other. All that stuff has gone away.
And that's what I mean when I say that baseball has a unifying effect.
Yeah.
Like we're all the same. We're all trying to do the same thing and achieve the same goals. And, all of these other differences kind of, can melt away in that context.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, before we say goodbye to Stu today, I've got to do my usual house cleaning that I have to do at this point. And that is to thank everybody for either watching or listening to Barrel It Up. Please subscribe to the channel. Extremely important. Everybody says it. Every channel will tell you this, and it's true. We're not lying to you. It's true. It really helps us grow. Also, please give us a rating. It's a 1 to 5 rating, 5 being the best. And if you have any comments or if you have somebody you think should be on here, please leave those at barrelitup@yahoo.com. That will be in the description. You don't have to memorize that. If it's somebody you think would be a guest, please leave their name, their contact information, why you think they should be on here. I get some great guests that way. It's fantastic. If you would like to see our complete list of guests, go to jjambrone.com. Look on page 5. There's the list of all 102 shows on there, and you can scroll through that and find somebody who you think would be really interesting. Don't worry about the spelling of that. That'll be there. Don't worry. Also, in the description will be the contact information about how to get in touch with Stu about getting one of the books. I'm not going to send you one. You got to pay for them. Help him out. There's also video clips now available, and hopefully this one will be one of those. That's on Facebook and Instagram. On Instagram, you go to Barrel_It_Up was the fastest way to get to that. There'll be a bunch of video clips of various shows on there. Hopefully very soon we'll be on YouTube, and you'll be able to get to see complete versions on YouTube. And I want to thank the people who make this show possible, TJ and Pod Populi, who does all my editing and distribution. Every single podcast platform we are on through them. And I want to thank Susan, my executive producer, and Robin, my associate producer, for all the help that they give me. They didn't have to do anything today. We got started very excellently today, so nobody had to come into the room and figure everything out. But before we leave, Stu, is there a quote or a sentiment that you'd like to finish up with before we do this?
Well, the first sentiment I'd like to express is I'd love all of your audience to grab a copy of this book.
Yeah.
And there's two ways you can do that. As Jay said, it'll be listed there with the podcast. But also, just if you want, you can jot down one of two things or both of these two things. The first way is you can just send an email to salraben11, salraben11@gmail.com with your address and the number of copies that you want. And we'll get back to you and make arrangements for payment and all that kind of stuff. The other way you can do it is if you want to pay by credit card, you can go to my other website, deadheadcyclist.com, and just follow the prompts to, you know, order a copy of the book. You can order either or both books on that website, deadheadcyclist.com. And towards the end of the book, the main character, Sal, has to decide if he's going to level with his teammates about what he's done without their knowledge, let's just say. And he writes a mea culpa in advance of, he's thinking about whether he should do it in the form of an email or whether they should hold a team meeting. And as an exercise, he writes down in the email what he wants to say to his teammates. And part of that mea culpa goes like this: I have learned that my relationships with all of you and with our entire baseball community are more important than winning and losing games. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with winning games, and I will continue to do my utmost to excel on the ball field in the aim of competing successfully. However, on the ball field of life, the love we share of baseball and the privilege we have of being teammates and friends must always take precedence over what can only be described as the addiction to winning baseball games. Put another way, the things we do for love are far more important than the things we do for glove.
Fantastic.
And that's sort of the salient statement of the of the story. Of course, there's a lot more to it than that, and I hope to hear from people and get feedback on the book, and I hope you'll all grab a copy. They're only $19.95 plus shipping, so it's not a big investment.
No, that's pretty good price these days for books. Yeah,
I can promise you that if you love baseball, you'll love this book.
Fantastic,
Stu. Thank you so much for being on the show. And hopefully everybody gets a chance to get one of the books.
Thank you, Jay. I appreciate it very much. Enjoyed it.
The This summer, I'm shopping the small space solutions that America waited 250 years for at Bob's Discount Furniture. Bob's has everything from retro chic bedroom sets with plenty of storage, party-ready dining sets in four fun colors, stylish and space-conscious Bobopedic sofas, to feature-packed power recliners that let me kick back all summer long. So, when you're ready to snag latest trends in small space styling, stop in or shop online at Bob's Discount Furniture, where America shops for furniture.